In the aftermath of 9/11, some Arab and Muslim American children often found themselves caught between two worlds, the American world in which they lived and had grown up, and this other identity that was suddenly assigned to them because of their appearance, ethnicity, or religion. The suspicious looks, the name-calling, in some cases outright hostility. Author Mustafa Bayoumi tells the stories of seven young Arab Americans and their struggles to navigate this new world after 9/11. His new book is called How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Being Young and Arab in America. And he joins us now from our studios in New York. Welcome. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How did you get the idea for the book?
I had spent several years after September 11 writing op-eds and giving lectures across the campuses, across the country. And it just seemed to me at a certain point that I was exhausted by always responding to the events of the day. And I wanted to assess and think about what had happened to the community, you know, from another kind of vantage point. And it seemed to me that young people was really a good place to do that from. Young people, I think, have a different kind of reality. If you think about September 11 now being 7 years away, most of their adult lives will be framed by this. And so I thought that that was a really interesting and important place to start from.
Where did the title come from?
The title is from W.E.B. Du Bois's classic, The Souls of Black Folk. People are coming up to him and asking him about what does he think about these Southern outrages and lynchings, etc. Or sometimes he says, they say to him, how does it feel to be a problem? And I thought that was a really good question. And Du Bois asks it in that book because he really wants to bridge the gap between African Americans and the rest of American society during segregation. And I wanted to ask the same thing during this period in American history.
You grew up overseas. You grew up in Switzerland, and you were raised in Canada. But you're very conversant with American history. I just wondered, had you, before 9/11, did you ever feel like a problem?
Of course, growing up as a minority, growing up as an Arab and as a Muslim in Western culture, often makes you feel like you are a minority. And that experience predates September 11. But I think September 11 really, in a lot of ways, solidified and transformed and brought a new kind of identity to a newer generation.
And give an example.
You know, prior to September 11, it was a lot easier for Arab Americans to, in some ways, pass for any kind of ethnicity. They might, if they're lighter skinned, for example, many might consider themselves Italian or something like that. After 9/11, you get a very small minority that seemed to, for a while, wanted to pass as Latino. Immediately right after 9/11, this happened in some of the high schools in Brooklyn, some of my friends have told me. But more than anything, I think that what happened was a stronger and a more devoted sense of being either Arab or being Muslim in the wake of all of the prejudice that you were confronting. So it seems to me that what happened was that a lot of the younger people decided that they really wanted to be able to inhabit and define themselves within an identity that was under siege. And instead of being defined by the culture outside, they were taking charge of the definitions of their own identity.
How did you decide which stories to tell?
I thought it would be interesting if I could find an Arab-American soldier who would fight in Iraq. And I thought also a story about a woman from Iraq, an Iraqi-American, would also be inherently interesting. But I didn't come with any expectations. And once I found the people and I heard their stories, I realized that these were the stories that were going to be in the book.
Let's talk about some of them. I'm not even sure where to start because they're all interesting. I know I want to hear more about Yasmin.
Sure. Okay. Yasmin is, you know, I think I call her something like a heavyweight fighter in a 95-pound frame. She was in high school when she decided to run for her student government. And she succeeded, and she was thrilled. She never thought that the people would vote for her, especially since she's religious and she wears hijab. And she thought that that would be a liability for her popularity in high school. But it wasn't. In fact, people voted for her, and she, overwhelmingly. So she starts in student government, and she's thrilled and excited. But then it's time for the first school dance. And she wouldn't go to the school dances. And
well, for one reason, some of them are on Friday.
Right.
Which is a holy day, and sometimes, I mean, well, at that age, alcohol is not supposed to be served, but just in general, is it the whole mixing of genders, or there's that kind of socializing, she considered sort of outside the boundaries of her practice, right, of her religious practice, right?
Yes, that's mm-hmm. exactly it. And she told her father, and her father also consulted a local religious leader, and then they determined that dances were not really something that they wanted to participate in. So she told the person who was in charge, the coordinator of student affairs in her school, and then he responded by saying, well, anybody who is part of student government has to participate in all student functions, including dances. She felt that this was inherently unfair, that it was somehow it would exclude all the Muslims from, or people who were like her, from participating in student government. And she offered, in fact, to make some kind of accommodation so that she would help in setting up the dance and help in taking it down and these sorts of things, but just not be present during the dance. Anyways, what happens in the end is that they decide, she feels that she's eventually forced to resign her position, and she does so, and she's very, very upset by this. And so she spends the next 2 or 3 years trying everything she can to overturn the school's decision. And she does everything that a 16-year-old can. She goes to the library. She takes out books like Sue the Dummies and et cetera, et cetera. Learns everything that she can about the law. Nobody pays her any attention until finally she does start to get some attention from some lawyers. And she gets a newfound respect from the coordinator of student affairs. And eventually she actually does run again for another office in for presidency of her school.
And we have to know how it turns out.
Okay.
We have to know.
Well, actually, she succeeds, and she becomes the president of her school. So it's a story of triumph. And her plans before going into high school were to go to medical school, something her father had wanted for a long time. And this experience fundamentally transformed her. And since then, she has decided she was going to go into law school. And she actually now is in law school.
Really, this is the made-for-TV movie. Because you can imagine her parents, if of all the things they thought she should probably be spending her high school time on, running for student office and then trying to sue them so that she could actually do the job, was probably not their highest priority. Why don't you tell me a little bit about Rasha's story? And if you don't mind, perhaps you could read a little bit.
Sure. Rasha has lived in the United States for about 20 years of her 25 years of living. But her family comes from Syria. And they had unresolved immigration issues like many people do in this country. They actually have had an asylum claim that was pending around the time of September 11. And so about 6 months after September 11, Rasha and her family were detained and taken to prison for about 3 months long. And their story is one of thousands of other stories from people who were arrested in really those first months. There were mass arrests that were at least 5,000, perhaps more people were in similar circumstances.
Would you read an excerpt?
Yeah,
okay,
sure.
Go ahead.
This was no accidental arrest. The man seemed to know everything about the family, including the fact that Rasha's two youngest brothers, both minors, were U.S. citizens. He turned to Rasha's father and told him to arrange custody for the boys. Rasha's father suggested that his brother, who lives in New York City, could take care of them. He asked to call him, suggesting that the authorities wait before transporting them to Federal Plaza until his brother could arrive. But the agent torpedoed the idea. That would take too long, he said, and instructed him instead to wake the tenants below and leave the boys there. Rasha's father had no choice but to comply, and when they were ready to go, the agent turned to the entire family and said, "We're going to handcuff you now." Later, Rasha learned why her eldest brother had already been not only handcuffed but shackled. Munir, her brother, is a deep and stubborn sleeper, and when an agent went to his downstairs bedroom to wake him, Munir was uncooperative. "Why?" he kept asking. "Come on, get up," the agent said. And Munir asked why again. "Get up," the agent yelled. "Get up and put your hands together, like the way you pray." Munir swore at him and told him to get the hell away. So they shackled him. Rasha told me, you know, to tame him.
What happened to Rasha?
They were released after about 3 months. And after this experience, she was quite traumatized. And the whole family was in their own separate ways. You know, she decided...
And I just need to point out, when you're talking about detained, we're talking about every member of the family strip searched, every member of the family handcuffed, you know, transported in shackles and so forth. I just think that's important to point out.
Yeah, and it was very traumatic. And in fact, what was interesting for Rasha was she saw the insides of the immigration detention system and the criminal justice system. And so she was resolved after leaving this to work towards making a better world. And she was resolved to enter into a program that was working towards getting rid of human rights violations around the world.
What do you think is the state of acceptance of Muslim and Arab Americans? I mean, there's so much data, contradictory data, sort of data. On the one hand, you know, Barack Obama has had to continually face the question of whether he is a closet Muslim or not. And it's clearly intended to be a slur. And it shouldn't be a slur. I mean, he doesn't have to face the closet accusation that he's a man. Right, right. So clearly, the fact that people are repeating this untruth that he's a Muslim is meant to be a negative, right? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you do have stories like the one in your book, like Yasmin, who who, faced with tremendous opposition and, you know, one could argue just prejudice, but she triumphed. So when you put it all together, is the glass half full or half empty?
I think it's a mixed bag, you know. In some ways, there's a lot of drive for inclusion, acceptance, for understanding, really, the complex nature of society, of American society. And on the other hand, I do feel that there's also this drive. You know, there was a poll done last year that said something like 76% of young Arab Americans encountered discrimination. That's a very high number, it seems to me. You have both things going on at the same time. You have Obama, as you say, running away from this rumor and his website calling it a smear. And then you have people like Andre Carson and Keith Ellison actually voted in to Congress. And so now you have Muslims in government at the same time. So I see both things happening. And it's not clear to me which direction society is going right now.
Okay. And finally, it's been 7 years since the 9/11 attacks. If you and I were to reconnect 7 years from now, and if you, for example, decided to tell the stories of seven more young people, what do you think those stories would be? Do you think that they'll be the same? Do you think they'll be different?
I hope that they would be. But I think what it's dependent upon is what are the foreign policy objectives of the United States 7 years from now. It's not just the terrorist attacks of September 11 that have created the environment in which we live right now. Those were criminal acts, and we should condemn them out absolutely. It's also been the war in Afghanistan and Iraq and this kind of heightened state of political violence and tension that we have around the world. I think that if the United States were to pursue a different kind of foreign policy based more on equality for everybody around the world, that would actually lessen the degrees of political violence that we encounter, and that would be good for everyone.
How would that affect these young people at home?
I think that people would be less quick to judge them based on their ethnicity or their religion or their name or the taint of their skin or the kink of their hair, these sorts of things.
Mustafa Bayoumi is the author of How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Being Young and Arab in America. He joined us from our studio in New York. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Author Curtis Sittenfeld burst onto the literary scene a few years ago with PrEP. Her fictional account of a boarding school in New England became a bestseller. Today, Sittenfeld tells us about three books, all by women, that shaped her own sensibilities as an author. It's for our series, Three Books, where writers pick three books on one theme.
A few years ago, I got myself in a bit of hot water because I wrote a book review in which I implied that not only was the book in question not good because it was chick lit, but that no chick lit was ever good. What I learned is that there's no consensus on what chick lit even is. Is chick lit any book by or about a young woman? Any book by or about any woman? These days, I no longer claim to know what chick lit is or isn't, but I do know that when I read a great, smart book about a young woman making her way in the world, it's a reason to rejoice. The Blindfold by Siri Hustvedt follows Iris, who's a graduate student at Columbia University, getting her PhD in English literature. The book is divided into four long chapters, and in each one, Iris finds herself entangled in a psychologically complicated situation. In the first, she's hired by an eccentric man to tape herself describing objects which once belonged to a dead girl. Iris is supposed to speak only in a whisper, and the girl the things belong to might have been murdered. In another chapter, Iris is hospitalized because she's been having migraines, and she ends up with two older female roommates who have their own bizarre habits. Published in 1992, The Blindfold is a dark, strange book, and something I love about it is that its intelligence is never announced. It's simply implied in every precise observation and sharp insight. In The Lost Father by Mona Simpson, Mayan is a 28-year-old medical student, though her life's obsession isn't medicine. Instead, as the title suggests, it's her father. Born and raised in Egypt, her father left her and her American mother in Wisconsin when Mayan was young, and she hasn't seen him since childhood. He could come back any day, so we had to be ready all the time, Mayan explains. We lived like that, jangled, for years, looking over our shoulders, feeling nervous and watched, expecting. Simpson's sense of detail is dazzling, and she writes in a brilliantly intuitive style that makes you feel as if you are Mayan, searching for your own missing father. What makes The Quality of Life Report by Megan Daum, which came out in 2003, one of my all-time favorite books, is how funny it is. Lifestyle reporter Lucinda Trout moves from New York to Prairie City, which is a stand-in for Lincoln, Nebraska. Daum's depiction of a liberal Midwestern town manages to be both mocking and affectionate. Daum, who also writes nonfiction, is one of those writers I'd read on any subject. She's so smart, so hilarious, and so honest about the way people really are, for good and bad. Together, Siri Hustvedt, Mona Simpson, and Megan Daum not only make me grateful as a reader, they also make me proud to be a chick.
Curtis Sittenfeld is the author of Prep. Her latest book is called American Wife. Her fiction picks are The Blindfold by Siri Hustvedt, The Lost Father by Mona Simpson, and The Quality of Life Report by Megan Daum. For more Three Books recommendations, go to our website, npr.org.
I am Netta Ulaby. This week on NPR's podcast, Book Tour, we'll hear bestselling author Brina Clark reading from her new novel, Stand the Storm. It's set in the turbulent era of the U.S. Civil War, and it's about a former slave who goes to extraordinary lengths to save what remains of her family.
When the sun came up, Sewing Annie slapped Gabriel's hands again. This time she roused him from sleep. "Finish up your work, good boy," she said, and could easily have kneaded his face and his newly muscled body between her hands, exercising a mother's claim. But she cared not to crimp him, or shame him, or turn away whatever he would give her. Rather, she stood and looked at him fully and savored him.
For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction, please go to npr.org/booktour.
As the saying goes about New York City, there are 8 million stories in the Naked City. A few of them, more than a few of them, they aren't true. That's because they were made up by my guest, Lee Israel. Lee is the author of the new memoir, Can You Ever Forgive Me? In it, she details a period of her life as a literary forger. She faked letters from famous dead celebrities, Noel Coward, Dorothy Parker, Lillian Hellman, and then sold them to dealers. Lee Israel, welcome to the program.
Thank you. They're dead. They had to be dead.
Yeah, because otherwise they'd say, I didn't write that.
I would have heard.
All right. Well, let's get a little background on you first. For a while, you were doing okay. You were a successful biographer. One of your books was on Tallulah Bankhead. And what happened? What drove you to forging letters?
There were three books, all of them well-received. I did Tallulah. I did Dorothy Kilgallen. And finally, a book about Estee Lauder. The third was not so successful, and that began my downward tumble.
Your downward tumble. So you actually did this because you didn't have a lot of money, right?
I did this to survive.
Yeah. So how did you come up with this idea?
It happened incrementally, like most evil things do. I needed the dome. I was in a lot of trouble. The proximate need for money had to do with my sick cat. I went to the library and was given a bunch of letters, which I should not have been given in a non-secure area. I needed to come up with $40 to get my kitty's Doris's test back. And I took a couple of Fanny Bryce letters, slipped them in my sneakers, and sold them to a place called Argosy on the east side of New York City.
So these were actual letters that you
these
sold?
These were actual letters from Fanny Bryce. I got about $40 a piece for them. And for the first time in a long time, I had some jingle in my jeans.
So how did you go from stealing to actually forging letters?
Some of the autograph dealers told me that they would pay more for better content. So there was a big white space at the bottom of a letter after yours truly, Fanny Bryce. I got an old typewriter and I wrote a couple of hot sentences that improved the letter and elevated the price.
And then you moved on. You moved on to Louise Brooks.
Yeah, well, it wasn't moving on. I stopped stealing. I used what talent I had and what voice I had to duplicate the voice and the letters of some very famous people.
Can you read a little bit?
Well, I can read a Dorothy Parker.
Okay, read a Dorothy
okay.
Parker. That'd be great.
This one is Dateline Thanksgiving from Dorothy Parker. It says, "Dear Joshua, Alan told me to write and apologize, so I'm doing that now while he dresses for our turkey dinner with the boys across the road. I have a hangover that is a real museum piece. I'm sure that I must have said something terrible. To save me this kind of exertion in the future, I am thinking of having little letters run off saying, 'Can you ever forgive me, Dorothy? Can you ever forgive me, Dorothy?'"
So when you would sell these letters to the dealer, what would the dealer say to you?
"Thank you."
Just that? They wouldn't question the authenticity?
No.
That's it?
Well, okay. The dealers were spectacularly incurious. I was never asked. I had a whole cock and bull story made up about the cousin who died and left me these wonderful letters. I never had to explain.
Eventually, you were caught.
Yeah.
How did you get caught?
Well, it was an old coward what done me in. The overhanging theme mostly was his sophistication and his homosexuality. So there were a lot of references to Dear Boys and Hey Boy and How is Bernice and that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is, and I don't think I gave it much thought, but somebody else did, an old coward came up in a very difficult period to be homosexual. It was a jailing offense. So it would have been very unlikely for a coward to have put all these kind of campy truths into any kind of correspondence that went out into the world, and somebody said, hey, I don't think so, and a couple of dealers talked to each other and told the other dealers, don't you dare sell those, they're toxic, they come from Lee Israel's well, and that was the end of my career as a forger.
And there was actually an FBI sting, right?
Yeah, there was a sting. Yes.
You can laugh about it now, but that
well,
sounds
yeah,
pretty
it wasn't,
serious.
I wasn't laughing then. I was really scared. It was awful. It was, you know, it was the FBI showing me a badge of the sun outside of a fancy delicatessen. I had started to steal letters. After it was known that my letters were forgeries, I couldn't no longer sell. So this is when I think it gets bad. I mean evil. I mean, you know, bad. Hold your ears if you can't stand it. I went to very prestigious archives, and I would duplicate the letter. I'd go back to the library, and I'd switch. And then I'd have a real letter from usually a very well-known writer, and a friend of mine would sell the letters.
So 400 of these letters you wrote, how many of them were actually tracked down? How many of them were used for serious scholarship and actually
well,
made it
yeah.
into
the Noel like Coward collection? The editor of that was fooled and used actually three letters of mine in the collected letters of Noel Coward. One of them was almost the 11 o'clock number. I mean, he was obviously very amused by the letter, and it was very good Coward. It was better Coward than Coward. I mean, Coward didn't have to be Coward. I had to be Coward and a half. So it was witty and it was fun, and he was taken in, and the book was published with my letters. The paperback will be issued without my letters.
And did you ever think, this is just wrong, I can't do this anymore, I can't deceive people anymore, I just can't bear
yes,
this.
Yes, as soon as the FBI showed up.
As soon as you were caught, in other words.
As soon as I was caught.
So you didn't think you were doing anything wrong?
Oh, I knew I was doing something wrong. I'm not a sociopath. Of course I knew. But I also knew that I had no choice, it seemed to me.
Well, you know, I want to ask the obvious question, but I think it needs to be asked. How do we know you're telling the truth in this memoir?
It was thoroughly, thoroughly vetted. You can check it. You can see it. You couldn't make this up.
Have you received any criticism at all from the literary dealers that you...
They're not happy.
No.
They're not happy. But it has come to my attention that some of the letters are now on the market as Lee Israel's forgeries. And they're being sold qua forgeries. Nobody's deceiving anyone. But my work has received some attention and marvelous reviews, and people have liked the letters, and so they're saleable, apparently.
Lee Israel is the author of the book Can You Ever Forgive Me? Memoirs of a Literary Forger. Lee Israel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It appears they can forgive her. Want to read some of Lee Israel's forged letters? Just go to our website, npr.org. Day to Day is a wholly authentic production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Madeline Brand.
Really? I'm Alex Chadwick.
John McCain's 23-year-old daughter, Meghan McCain. She's been a constant presence on the campaign trail. She's been blogging about her experience all along, and now she's written a new children's picture book. It's about her father's life on the campaign trail, but also his life as a war hero. It's called My Dad, John McCain. I asked Meghan McCain how she managed to write this over the last year.
I'm a really bad insomniac. I only sleep like 3 or 4 hours a night, so that helps, you know, because sometimes the day normally ends now at like 6 or 7, and Simon & Schuster approached me a long time ago, like 6 months ago, something like that. I'm sorry, my memory blurs together on the dates, and they were just like, do you have any interest in doing this? And I was like, let me see what I can do. You know, this is obviously very deep material and intense. You know, it's a war and torture. And I started trying it, and then I worked with an editor, and I really liked the way it turned out.
This is tough stuff for kids. How did you deal with the torture in particular and trying to decide how you were going to tell that part of the story?
Well, obviously, it's very delicate because this book is for 5 to 11-year-olds. But I find that the people and the kids that have read it, the feedback that I've gotten is that, you know, kids like adventure, and especially since this is a real story. So I think it's gone over pretty well.
When you were young,
mm-hmm.
about the age of the kids that are going to be reading this book,
mm-hmm.
how much did you understand of your father's experience in the war?
Very little. You know, I think I have still not entirely read his book, Faith in My Fathers. I have in parts, but I find it very hard to read the chapters about torture. I just find it, you know, it's very different when it's your father you're reading about being tortured and these horrible things going on. So when I was little, I conceptually sort of understood his life, but I don't think you really understand it until you get older. And when I was a sophomore in college, his movie came out, Faith of My Fathers, and I think that's when it really, 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 really came to life. But even now, it's hard for me to talk about. I mean, no one wants to imagine the father that they love being tortured, you know?
Megan, I want to go back to something that you said earlier, that you hadn't completely read your father's book.
Yeah, I've read most of it, but I have to skip over some of the pages where he's being tortured. Like, it makes me cry, you know, and it just, I've read it, but I haven't, like, the pages that he was being tortured, I had to skip some paragraphs, and like I said, it makes me cry, so.
Now, you said when you were on the Today Show that because you've taken on such a public role, you're, to use your own words, fair game. Your father's campaign is very upset. Mm-hmm. About the media coverage of Sarah Palin in the now almost 2 weeks since she's been named as your father's running mate. On the other side, some say that there's a double standard at work. If she's going to step into the spotlight, that she should face the same kind of scrutiny that any other vice presidential candidate would face.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you come down on that? Is there a double standard, or does she need to face the same degree of scrutiny that any other candidate would face?
Well, I think that no matter who the person is, no matter what gender they are, being the vice presidential nominee, the public has a right to know as many of the facts as possible. What I do think is unfair, and this is something that I have discussed with my parents and my friends, is I do think that there is an element of sexism going on in the media.
If the campaign is introducing her to the country, and if part of that is pointing to her ability to juggle work and family responsibilities, why is it unfair to ask about her family responsibilities?
I think it's fair to ask her about her family responsibilities. I don't think it's fair to attack her children.
And when you say attack her children, I just want to make sure I understand what you're referring to.
Oh, I'm just referring to the way Bristol's been treated. She's the sweetest girl, and we've gotten to be very good friends. Obviously, you become fast friends when you're in a situation like this, and I just wish that people would leave her alone. You know, it's obviously everyone knows she's pregnant now, and she's going to live her life, but, you know, I wish people would give her a little bit more privacy.
Well, Megan McCain, it's been great to talk to you. I understand that you have to go. Congratulations on the book. Thanks for making time to talk to us.
Thank you for making time to talk to me. It's a pleasure.
Megan McCain. Her book is called My Dad, John McCain.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.